As we wrestle with the words of Scripture, may our hearts and minds be open to your word, dear Lord, and may we receive your blessing with humble gratitude. You may have heard the famous saying attributed to Teresa of Avila when she addressed God. She said, "If this is the way you treat your friends, no wonder you have so few." Well, it could have been said by Job himself, as Job is God's friend indeed, a righteous man, if ever there was one, blameless, upright, and religious in every way. But prompted by Satan, God decides to see if Job's righteousness is offered freely, or if it's simply a response to the many blessings God has given him. So to do this, God takes it all away, and Job ends up on a heap of ashes, scratching his sores with a broken piece of pottery. Having lost his family, his fortune, his health, and his social position. Three friends, the so-called Job's comforters, try to convince him that all that suffering is simply the retribution of his sins. As we know, much of religion over the centuries has focused on that sort of morality of retribution. And it continues to do so. We heard an example last Sunday with Cara's sermon. But Job knows that he has done nothing worthy of such terrible treatment. So he refuses to be silent, and he complains bitterly. Indeed, I don't know how so often Job is depicted as a symbol of patience. He's nothing of the sort. He argues, he rails against God, he curses, he shakes his fist at God and says, "Why are you allowing this to happen? I've always been very good. So why do you treat me like this? Answer me," shouts Job. But God remains silent. And not just for a little while in order to allow Job to let off steam, but for 38 chapters out of 42. Almost 90% of the book is about Job's unjustified suffering without a peep from God. No wonder Job is mightily angry and keeps asking the question that all of us have asked at some point in our life. Why me? What have I done to deserve this? Why such bad things happen to good people? A child dies, a loved one is struck with an incurable disease, a drunk driver takes the life of a mother of three, a random gun attack kills dozens of young lives, millions of refugees are bombed out of their homes. Hunger and poverty kill 20,000 people per day. Why? Why? Answer me! How we can identify with Job. But then, finally, God answers. Not a moment too soon, if you ask me, but what sort of answer is it? Incredibly odd and frustrating. Job has indicted God for crimes against humanity and for indifference to suffering. And what does God say? Well, a lot, certainly, but not what Job hopes for. Job wants to know why there is evil and injustice. And God takes him on a safari or on a Nature Appreciation Society field trip. We hear about fierce lions, frolicking whales, powerful hippos, about the power of the oceans, the beauty of the dawn, the depth of the cosmos. Job as ask why he's suffering without reason. And he gets a great big poem. Admittedly, the greatest poem, whether of ancient or modern literature, according to Tennyson. Mind you, this is not what everybody thinks about God's poetry, the beginning of which we heard today. The popular novelist Louis de Bernière has some vitriolic words to describe it. He says, "God comes out of this story looking like an unpleasant and sarcastic megalomaniac who devotes 129 verses to a magnificently irrelevant and bombastic speech about his own accomplishments and abilities." Wow, harsh to put it mildly. But it seems true, as God keeps asking Job, "Were you present when I made all that? Did you participate in the creation of any of it? Have you had any input when I created the deer and the lion and the ostrich and the eagle and the dew and the wind and the rain?" And this line of questioning, which begins in chapter 38, as we heard, continues right on through the penultimate chapter of the book, chapter 41. And even if the lectionary has selected only 18 verses, there are 129 of it, and these verses should not be read in isolation. So, what are we to make of this strange answer? What does it say to Job, and more importantly, of course, to us personally? Are God's questions intended to batter Job further, showing him and us how insignificant he and we truly are in the scheme of things, and that his and our concerns and suffering are irrelevant? No, of course not. The first thing to say about God's answer is that he answers. A bit late, I grant you, but he does answer. In other words, whether or not Job and we can feel God's presence, God is there. And it is a God who has invested in people by offering them his creation. But is that often unfelt presence of God in our life enough to give solace and healing to us when we suffer? Not really, if we are honest. And when the church give us pop theology and ready-made moralizing banalities about this, I think it's doing more harm than good. Why? Because there is no easy answer. And I do believe that when God directs our attention to the dimension of outer space, the depth of the oceans, the power of thunderstorms, the cunning of lions, the loveliness of mountain goats, and the soaring wonder of eagles, it is not intended to cancel out or disregard Job's suffering and ours. God does not answer Job's question about suffering because no answer, even one from God, is ever satisfactory in the midst of our pain and grief. Nothing solves suffering. Nothing answers it. However, what God is saying in this amazingly beautiful poem is that suffering is not the whole story of our lives and of the world. There is beauty, there is grace, there is hope in the world too, existing at the same time in paradox with evil and suffering. Admittedly, it is hard to hold both truth in our head at the same time, and even more difficult in our souls. But both are true to our experience, and each has its own wisdom and gift for our life of faith. To choose to see beauty and the positive in the world is indeed a choice. It doesn't take away the suffering and the negative, But it is the chosen emphasis which is different. In fact, we need both. We need to cultivate both, an awareness of the suffering of humanity and an awareness of the beauty of the creation. We need to experience both the remote absence of God and the divine immanence of a God who is with us in creation. Like suffering, beauty cannot really be explained. Like suffering, beauty can only really be experienced. But like suffering, beauty changes us. What suffering and grief can do is to remove the protective fences of wealth and privilege we have erected and open our eyes to the deep suffering in the world. But if all we experience is grief and suffering, like Job, we can spiral into despair and become paralyzed and not be able to alleviate the earth's suffering. On the other hand, if all we see is beauty and grace, we can spiral into lofty ideals and piousness and become so detached from the reality of human suffering that we become just as paralyzed and inefficient. Both are incomplete without the other. Just as Job is pleading with God to look at the world and bear witness to its suffering and pain, God is in turn pleading with Job to look at the world and bear witness to its beauty and glory. So humanity needs the divine, but the divine needs the gritty realities of humanity. And that's the change we see in the book of Job at the end. God and Job finally see each other eye to eye. At the beginning of the book, Job and God are far removed from each other. In a heavenly court, God is a distant observer, considering his servant Job from afar. And from Job, God is a distant provider, showering wealth and blessing upon him. But by the time the book ends, things have changed. The divine courtroom, where God and Satan launch their wager, has been replaced by an earthly one, where Job and God argue. And the picture we see of God is not of a removed being, but of a God who is intimately involved and present in every corner of the earth, from the most insignificant creatures to the most massive ones in the creation. God is no longer above humanity, but alongside, so much so that Job can say, "Before, I had only heard about God. Now I have seen God." Now, is this an adequate response to Job's suffering? Probably not. Not in a conventional sense, in any case. And God would probably fail a present-day pastoral care class. But God's speeches at the end of the book that we heard, or the beginning at least, still accomplish something extremely profound. They move Job out of his endless cycle of grief into life again. They enable him to live in a world, yes, full of heartbreaking suffering, but also of heart-stopping beauty. And all that has been achieved without pious moralizing and inadequate comforting words. Because what the book of Job also teaches us is that it's okay to protest and to lament and to complain and to be angry with God. Because God likes sincerity and humanity. And he prefers Job's outrage to his comforter's know-all conventional wisdom. The famous American writer and preacher, Barbara Brown Taylor, expresses it like this. She says, "Devout defiance pleases God." I like that. In fact, Job's anger is a deep, raw, primal form of faith, a kind of faith which trusts God enough to question God and allows Job to become close to God. In fact, it reminds me of the ancient art of wrestling. I'm not talking about the Olympic sport, but about the traditional kind, practiced by many villagers all over the world, probably since time immemorial. I have personally seen it in Senegal and in Turkey. And what struck me immediately was how close the two opponents come to each other when they wrestle. Almost, I dare say, in a sort of intimacy. It's not like boxing or any martial art that I have ever seen. The wrestlers grapple each other, smell each other's sweat, feel each other's breath. And I think it is a bit the same sort of wrestling when we dare to challenge God and question God. It's raw, it's hard, it's primal, might not be very pretty and elegant, but it's authentic. It engages all of who we are, and it allows us to become closer to God. Now, having said all that, there is no doubt that the silence of God in the face of injustice, misery, and suffering remains for many one of the biggest conundrums of faith. Many faith journeys have stumbled because of it, including my own. But faith, by its very nature, is not the product of right answers. The deepest places of our knowledge of God are often those places that we cannot explain. Job's questions and ours about suffering and evil are never answered, and we can only be comforted by knowing that an encounter with God is possible, even if that encounter might leave us limping, like Jacob. Someone said, "Life is not for the faint-hearted." So remember God's opening words in his answer to Job. "Gird up your loins like a warrior or like a man." Amen.